This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
My name is Hokio. I'm from Illinois, just north of Chicago. I come here sometimes to. Are you from Chicago? No. I come here about once a year to visit with you all and be with you. So tomorrow we'll be starting the Tanjue Sesshin. It's a 7-day Sesshin in honor of the Buddha's birthday. And so after the Dharma talk, we're going to have a ceremony, and we invite you to join us. We'll proceed up, you know, how you came down the stairs, we'll proceed back up. And then we'll gather just below the parking lot. You'll see a bench with a bow there, and that's where you'll see the bowl there. And then we'll guide you, you know, so try to have a smooth way to process as we go through the ceremony. But you're welcome to join us after this talk. So there is a question asked in this space not long ago that I'd like to revisit. The question received a really good answer on this, you know, on the spur of the moment, and I'd like to visit it a little bit more in depth today, because the question is the kind of question that the Buddha heard a lot, and it's still with us. It never leaves us. So the question is, how can I cope with uncertainty? There is, you know, in my process, I find things that sort of resonate with me in terms of answering that question. And the question is always with me, because it's like the crux of the practice. This is from Donna Haraway, who's actually a professor emeritus at the University of California, Santa Cruz. This is from her book, Staying with the Trouble. Trouble is an interesting word. It derives from a 13th century verb meaning to stir up, to make cloudy, to disturb. We, all of us on Terra, live in disturbing times, mixed up times, troubling and turbid times. The task is to become capable with each other in all of our bumptious kinds of response. Mixed up times are overflowing with both pain and joy, with vastly unjust patterns of pain and joy, with unnecessary killing of ongoingness, but also with necessary resurgence. The task is to make kin in lines of inventive connection, as a practice of learning to live and die well with each other in a thick present. Our task is to make trouble, to stir up potent response to devastating events, as well as to settle troubled waters and rebuild quiet places. In urgent times, many of us are tempted to address trouble in terms of making an imagined future safe, of stopping something from happening that looms in the future, of clearing away the present and the past in order to make futures for coming generations. Staying with the trouble does not require such a relationship to times called the future. In fact, staying with the trouble requires learning to be truly present, not as a vanishing pivot between awful or Edenic pasts and apocalyptic or salvific futures, but as moral critters entwined in myriad unfinished configurations of places, times, matters, meanings. The Buddha had two primary teachings. He taught suffering, taught that there is suffering, and he taught that there is the cause of suffering, and he taught that there is a way to liberate from suffering. And he also taught dependent origination, and I also use the term dependent co-arising, because it just has a little bit more juice to it, more action to it. So I'm going to come back around to the long version of each of these, but I'm going to start with this, the short version that the Buddha offered up about dependent co-arising. This existing that exists. This arising that arises. This not existing, that no longer exists. This ceasing, that ceases. We'll contemplate that with the original question. How do I cope with uncertainty? This arising, or this existing, that exists. This arising, that arises. This not existing, that no longer exists. This ceasing, that ceases. The two, this and the teaching on suffering, they go together like honey and sweet. They're intertwined. The Buddha said, according to Bhikkhu Bodhi, that to understand the Dharma, or to understand dependent co-arising, is to understand the Dharma. And to understand the Dharma is to understand dependent co-arising. It's the juice here. This is the juice of the practice, bringing in this deep understanding, bringing it in a non-conceptual way into practice. This is the juice of the practice. This underlies everything in Buddhism. Everything. It's especially in Mahayana, the language of Mahayana. And it's the dynamics of understanding suffering. What are the causes and conditions that give rise to suffering? So when you think about that question, How do I cope with uncertainty? How do I learn to live with uncertainty? So when you listen to this very brief description of dependent co-arising, can you hear any certainty in that? I can't. So, you know, and then the question comes, what's behind that question? When you hear that question that was asked, what's behind it? How do I live with uncertainty? Is there an idea that there should be certainty? When you find yourself in uncertain times, what's happening? What are you experiencing? Fear? Do you hear fear in that question? So this is, you know, this is the Buddha's teaching. It brings it's always brings it right here. That thick present that Haraway talks about, right here. What's here? What's showing up here right now? Always, as Dogen says in Fukan Zazengi, always, you know, learning the step backward that shines a light in. Here, right here. So as you think about fear, let's not just think about it. Can you feel fear right now? Where you feel fear in your body? So it's a very visceral thing. Turning in, turning in. And as we turn in, you know, we're in it. We're in it. What your experience is, I'll share you my experiences with fear. And it may mask itself, and the fear may not be evident first right off. So an experience I had was there was anger. Where I live, I live maybe 6 miles. I don't know if any of you heard about the Highland Park shootings a few years ago on the 4th of July. I live about 6-7 miles from there. And I was thinking about that, and there was anger, and then there was hatred. But what gave rise to the hatred was the thinking pattern going on with it. So, are you hearing causes and conditions here? Causes and conditions. It was happening, and how it was manifesting in this organism. Okay. Then it went into hate. And then when it went into hate, I was with it in the body, and it felt really toxic. Hate is toxic. And I go, I don't want to spend too much time here, because it's not good for me, and it's not good for what may be going out into the cosmos from me. So I came back to the anger energy, and I rode with it. Don't be afraid of anger. Okay, don't be afraid of your emotions. And so anger, always remember this, anger is always a secondary emotion. There's always something underlying it. And one of those somethings that underlies it is fear. And so I came back into, I go, oh, there it is. And I came back into fear, how that was in my body. You see the movement? And we have it. I'm going to get back into this a little later, but the choices we have with awareness, it's a dance. This is a dance in uncertainty. This is the dance in dependent co-arising. The degree of awareness that this practice cultivates. And so I came back into the fear, and pretty soon it dissipated. So the longer version of, I'll go through this kind of quickly for you who are new to this practice, and maybe for some who aren't. Maybe you've heard of this, maybe you haven't, but the 12 links of dependent origination. And they are, the first link is ignorance. Bingo, ignorance. The second link is volition. It's habit patterns, our habit patterns that are wired into us. That started even before we were born, the wiring that started in the mother's womb, the wiring that started in her, going back to when she was in her mother's womb, on and on back. Plus the conditioning that we get once we come out of the womb. All that conditioning. And then with ignorance as a condition, it gives rise to volition. With volition as a condition, it gives rise to consciousness. And that's consciousness in the term, in the sense that it locates to hear these parameters of body. And so that being a condition, consciousness being a condition, it gives rise to name and form, mind and body. with those being a condition that gives rise to the senses. With those being a condition, it gives rise to contact. So you're my voice right now, that would be contact, right? And visual, all the things, contact. And then contact being a condition gives rise to feelings. And so feelings in this case are not emotions, but there are, is it pleasant, unpleasant, or neither? Now, with what we understand from neuroscience today, it goes down a little bit deeper, fight, flight, or freeze, right? Because the system, you can see how the system is always on. It's always responding to stimuli. Fight, flight, or freeze. So there's always that going to be that response, unless you're dead. With feelings as a condition, gives rise to craving. And with craving as a condition, it gives rise to clinging. As clinging as a condition, with clinging as a condition, it gives rise to becoming. With becoming giving as a condition, it gives rise to birth. With birth as a condition, it gives rise to old age and death. Now, in especially in the Tibetan teachings, you know, this is about the, you know, the dynamics that keeps us in the realms of samsara, you know, the cycle of birth and death and suffering and stuff. But you can, you know, it's also and or for you, whether, however you want to take it. But this is what you really need to take, is waking up in this. It shows you how you function. It shows you how we stay trapped in our habit patterns. And a good way, and a good place to focus is right at contact. Right at contact. And noticing, okay, how's the being responding? You know, you notice, I'm careful here. I'm not saying notice how you respond. It's how is the organism responding? Okay. And so that contact, then the sense of, you know, let me back up a little bit, going back to consciousness, you know, the location of here in this form, that's the beginning of the sense of self. And when it comes into contact, into craving, that is the selfing. The selfing is reified right there. Right there. Okay, that craving. So the karmic energy is in the second, the volition, the habit patterns. And in craving and clinging, that's the propellant that keeps this thing going. And so when we're focusing here on contact, craving, and clinging, and if you're alive in there, you can, you know, all these other patterns we become they start to light up in going back to the second link. Our habit patterns, it lights up and these connections start to be made. And then little by little, we start chipping away at that ignorance, the more we wake up to it. But you see, there's a host of causes and conditions at play. But the fundamental cause and condition to suffering, you know, is often said to be craving, but underneath that is selfing. Holding on to this idea of you. Think about that. Think about, oh, I don't think it should be this way. I think it should be that way. Well, what about me? That's the propellant right there. Holding on to this thing of me. Now, it's how do we work with that? The sense. Let me back up. When we really look at all of these dynamics, just ponder them. Where is a self in there? Where is there something pulling the levers? Oh, but I'm a bright person. What about all that? But you see how deeply that condition goes? It's not that we don't use that intelligence, but it's how we use that intelligence. It's just, you know, have any of you, I don't know if doctors, I haven't had it done to me for a while, but it used to every time I go in for a physical, you know, they do the little rubber hammer on the knee thing, right? The knee goes, boing, well, you're good. It's like that. This is just how this organism has been conditioned to respond to experience. Our job is to be awake to that. Our job is to be awake and to be able to take that step backward that turns the light in. And there, you know, it's just, and it's very experiential. Now you're hearing, you know, there are three ways of learning that the Buddha, you know, Buddhism talks about. There's listening and reading, there's contemplating, and there's sitting. I would suggest that you can do all of those and still be stuck in selfing. So it's this very, you know, what I encourage is this very direct experiencing. Turning in. You know, I work with a group of domestic violence offenders. I know they're not, well, some of them actually have taken up the practice of sitting. I've been really surprised. But I don't expect them to, but I do encourage them to pause. And it's been very beneficial to them. So, you know, you're sitting here in cushions, you can add the pause to your life, to the rest of your life now, right? You get some idea what's happening on the cushion. You know, the cushion sitting on the meditation is like, well, it's like a show. Sometimes you don't like the show. But it's about being open. When we're sitting, it's not about not thinking. It's about, oh, that's about the point. That's the narrative going through. And you notice what narratives reinforce certain things, what narratives, you know, how narratives and emotions go together. Emotions are simply chemical reactions in the body. They last about 90 seconds. And they'll flow through unless the thinking keeps them going. How many of you get stuck in spin cycles, replaying things over and over in your mind? How many of you go down into rabbit holes and have a hard time pulling yourself out? Okay. Now, there's, you know, there are different ways, you know, recommended to work on this in meditation. And, but what has really helped me is what I'm going to share with you. I'm a therapist. I'm supposed to be retired, but I still do therapy. And it, you know, when I started to do two somatic trainings around trauma and how to be awake to trauma in the body, one of them is called polyvagal. Maybe you've heard of that. And there are three aspects to the polyvagal. There's the sympathetic, there's the activation. Then there's the dorsal, and that's the freeze dynamic, shutdown, the depression, low energy. And then there's ventral vagal. The moment I step onto this property, I'm immediately in ventral vagal. And, you know, it's how, you know, how we're aware of our body, you know, so noticing these things, sympathetic, you know, for instance, I can go from sympathetic. And my conditioning pattern is drop down into dorsal. And when I do that, I lose my voice. I think that's happening to a lot of people these days. Going from activation, dropping down into, you know, being immobile to almost being numb. And so it's how we how we are with that, you know, dance with it. You know, you can use that, you can use that anger or sympathetic energy, ride with it until it sort of pops you back up. Becoming very intimate, turning in, what does it feel like? And then I heard an insight meditation teacher say, when you notice there's thinking, notice what it feels like. I go, oh, immediately made sense. So, you know, I'm suspicious. I'm a little suspicious. I don't know, kind of a lot suspicious about the letting go thing immediately as immediate response. Because we push away, we suppress a lot more than we pay attention to. We want to be alive to it when it comes in. So when we turn in, we notice that there's thinking. We're turning into the energy dynamic of thinking and emotional patterns and riding with them until they either fall away, or at a certain point we see where it's been going and you've been down that road many, many times, and you can say, oh, now I'm going to let it go. It's about, you know, getting really intimate with yourself. And it's not easy. And, you know, if there's trauma in there, it can really not be easy. So we need help. But so that, you know, no, there are no guarantees in this world, right? I hate to be a Debbie Downer, but there are no guarantees. There is no certainty, right? We go about, we plan for today, we plan for our tomorrow. We try to, you know, to have everything in line and set up. And, you know, but there are no guarantees. And this is what the Buddha taught. I want to share this from Mark Epstein from his book, The Trauma of Everyday Life. And he starts with something that I have, you know, I thought about it even before I was a therapist. I wonder what happened to this little kid that eventually, you know, who grew up to become Buddha. What happened to him because his mother died 7 days after he was born? That's trauma. And Epstein's the, you know, the only one I've seen that really takes it up. I began to appreciate that Buddhism demanded something more of me than studying, and also something more than just rote practice. Not that it did not engage my intellect, it did. He's a psychiatrist, pretty bright guy. And not that it did not encourage conceptual rigor and rigorous effort. Those were things I appreciated about it. But it demanded something in addition. I knew nothing of art at this time, but I can see now that Buddhism is as much an inner art as it is inner science. It is a formless art, to be sure. The only product is the self, and even that comes quickly into continuous question. But it is an art nonetheless, one that demands its own touch, one I could only understand to the extent that I could give myself over to it completely. This emphasis on surrender and process was not one that I knew before I came upon Buddhism. Perhaps if I had been a musician or an actor or a painter or a poet, it would have not seemed like such a revelation. But for me, it was like stumbling into a new reality, one in which I was suddenly being asked to give of myself in a new way. In Zen, the image of falling backward into a well is used to describe what it is like. For me, it was like feeling my way into myself while blindfolded, never quite sure what I would find. Feeling my way into myself, that was definitely what it was like. Feeling my way into all of the doubts and anxieties and insecurities and dis-ease that I would have been all too happy to get rid of, that I had initially hoped meditation would destroy. Feeling my way into them in my body as well as in my mind, and feeling my way through them, something changed as I embraced the art of meditation. Instead of approaching myself with dread, with the secret hope that I would rise above my personal struggles, I began to explore the texture of my own suffering. No one had ever told me such a thing was possible. As I practiced under the tutelage of a new generation of Buddhist teachers, I had trouble reconciling my experience with what I was learning from my Buddhist books. The fundamental psychological teaching of the Buddha was called anatman, or anatta, the language of the Buddha in Pali, the language of the Buddhist scriptures, a Sanskrit-related tongue related or closer to what the Buddha must have spoken, meaning no soul or no self. My Buddhist teachers stressed this at every opportunity. Part of my initial attraction to Buddhism lay in this central concept. I like that there is an alternative to the Western preoccupation with self, to the psychoanalytic effort to build up the ego. Where id was, their ego shall be, pronounced Freud, that I had already unconsciously subscribed to. Not quite ready to relinquish my id, still in the process of finding it, I liked the counterintuitive implications of no self, the allure of egolessness. I liked the very sound of it. It took away some kind of pressure that I had been feeling to make myself into someone I could put my finger on, something I could explain. It let me off the hook a little, relaxed me, gave me a sense of relief. No self. It had a nice ring. And then with this, he said, affirmation that I might but not be completely off base came to me from the Buddhist sutras themselves. In one, there is a story about a conversation between the Buddha and the king of Kosala, one of the kingdoms where the Buddha roamed. Why is it that your followers seem so different from those of other teachers and sects? This king wanted to know. You emphasize the inescapability of dukkha, the truth of suffering, and yet your monks look so full of life. The followers of other religions look haggard, coarse, pale, emaciated, and unprepossessing, the king went on, while your disciples are joyful, elated, jubilant, and exultant. They even seem lighthearted, the king continued, as if they have a gazelle's mind. This is indeed a strange religion. How was it that a willingness to embrace suffering yielded such a sense of vitality? So I just want to make, coming back to this suffering thing, and it's danced around a lot. I hear it, Well, he didn't really mean suffering. He meant dis-ease, stress, mm-hmm. anxiety. He meant suffering. And so he meant suffering as in the existential suffering that we all experience, right? Sickness, old age, death, loss, uncertainty. And then there is the system's response to it. So he talked about the two arrows or the two darts. The first is painful. And often the second, what we add to it is more painful. That's spin cycle, going down the rabbit hole. Not being with ourselves, not getting to know ourselves, so we can be in the dance with ourselves, with uncertainty. Do we have time for questions?
Yes, we have a short time for 3 or 4 questions.
Okay. Are there any questions? Yeah.
What is the title of the book you were reading from?
The Trauma of Everyday Life.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Your hand went up first, and then you. You.
Should we feel excited about this interview?
Excited? Well, I guess that depends on who you are and your conditioning. Some people may, you know, feel excited about it. Okay, they go, oh, okay, bring it on. And others aren't conditioned that way. Okay. And the conditioning thing is a big one. You know, again, you know, it's how your, you know, how your autonomic nervous system has been conditioned primarily. And the storylines that have been wound in there about how we relate with each other, with others, how we relate with the world. And so we get to know that. And then what happens, we may see that, well, when it comes to uncertainty, there's a lot of fear. And so we keep turning into that fear. And we are in it. And then when we keep doing it, this practice is a discovery process. We begin to discover about ourselves what we didn't know. And what happens, you know, when this stuff falls away over and over. So what's happening when you're turning into and you feel the activation fall away, the selfing has stopped. You've interrupted, you know, the selfing has been interrupted. And you feel that. Uchiyama Roshi, you know, wrote the book, Opening the Hand of Thought. There's a clinching. And when you feel that fall away, the heart opens up. There's a Dharma talk out there by Thani Saro Bhikkhu. I highly recommend it, called The Karma of Now. But see, so karmic patterns, conditioned patterns are always arriving each moment, and we are awake to them, right? And we begin to see these karmic patterns that trapped us. Thinking patterns and stuff, and it's not about making them go away. It's about turning into them, we're in the process of discovery when we drop away from our old narratives. I can't do this. You know, this isn't for me. Blah blah blah. Right. So it's discovery. It's not. There's no shoulds. Could you speak up just a little bit, please?
You mentioned when we see anger, like there is fear hide behind of it. But what hides behind fear?
Oh.
Does there anything behind under fear?
It's the fight flight dynamic. It's that first, you know, it's that first response, the systems, your organism's first response. And that's, you know, that's what's underneath that. So if, you know, if there's, you know, it, you know, there, and there's a perception process. So if you're walking, you know, the common, you know, the traditional one in Zen Buddhism is you're walking down a path and you see a rope and the mind, your system immediately goes snake. It happens that fast, you know, how the system is responding. And so we get a little bit better at being at that in that initial response, but it's very fundamental in us. It's a very primitive thing. It's just that animal response in us that then gives rise to fear, or maybe it gives rise, oh, to a rope. I could use that rope. So it's that's what underlies the fear. But you know, and it's, and we, and you, and you know, you've experienced the startle response, right? There, you know, we get to be really intimate with the organisms, you know, responding in our practice. Yeah.
I was wondering about the part where you were talking about the this and that. This exists, that exists, this doesn't exist, that ceases to exist. Is that more or less a way of pointing to the fact that yourself and reality are intertwined as one, and if something arises and exists within you, it begins to it begins, the situation begins to occur in your life somehow, that you're kind of creating that within you and then externally seeing that outwardly, as well as that kind of what that
kind means. Of. It's very simply as we exist only due to causes and conditions. And anger, emotions exist only due to causes and conditions, etc. So as we go about our life, when you go outside, when we leave here, go outside, notice just how the system is responding. Notice what it feels like in the body. And then, that you also notice somebody says something and giving and has a facial expression. And depending on your pattern of conditioning, your organism, your brain, your autonomic nervous system, your emotional patterns, it'll light up in a certain pattern. And I may see that facial expression as oh, and you may really go, oh, okay. So it's like having, sort of the dual awareness going on here. It's like, we're alive to what the environment we're in, but also really alive to what's arising. We're done. So we can chant out, and then again, I invite you up to join us for the Buddha's birthday ceremony. What we'll do, we've got this chant. It's called Inmejuku Kanonyo. We'll chant the Japanese version. It goes something like, I'll start off, the opening part is Inmejuku Kanonyo Kanze on Namu Butsu Yo Butsu Uin. Yo, butsu in. And we normally chant that seven times, but we're all going to be going up, and when we go up there, we'll approach it like somebody approaches this altar. He's a little bit away from it, bow to it, and then you sort of circle around up to the left up there, bow, and then you take the ladle that's there, and it's got sweet tea in there. And you'll ladle the sweet tea over the Buddha three times, and then return the ladle, and then you come back around and bow, and then we'll have you move to the right. We'll just keep going, and we'll just keep doing this chant. And after the last person, if we're still not completed with the round of chant that we're in, when the last person ladles the Buddha, then we'll finish it on to the end of that chant. Is that clear now? Okay.
Should people bring their chant books?
No, we have copies of it.
Oh,
okay. Up there. Now we might, you might have to share. I'm not sure, but we might have to share. Okay. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.